This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Greetings from Cheeselandia, where cheese lovers, cheese makers, cheese nibblers, and cheese curious are all welcome. Find the really good stuff, meet the makers, and connect with fellow travelers on the cheese way of life. Visit wisconsincheese.com to learn more and sign up.
Welcome to Inside Julia's Kitchen, the podcast of the Julia Child Foundation for Gastronomy and the Culinary Arts. I'm your host, Todd Shulkin, the Foundation's Executive Director. Our show takes you inside the Foundation's world to meet the talented people we have the great fortune of learning from all the time. On today's show, we welcome chef, restaurateur, and author Sheldon Simeon. In today's episode, we'll talk to Sheldon about genuine Hawaiian food, his new cookbook, Cook Real Hawaii, and we'll hear Sheldon's Julia moment. Stay with us. We'll be right back. As always, we launch the conversation with an inspiration from Julia. For Julia, travel and food were deeply connected. Learning what was behind the dishes she discovered in France, or China, or even Norway, led to a lifelong interest in exploring how food connects to culture. One of Julia's favorite ways of understanding a new place, whether city, state, or country, was to talk to chefs. After her time in France, Julia realized that chefs make great cultural ambassadors. They not only understand what epitomizes the best food from a specific place, but also the people and ethos behind it. While Julia relished personally learning from chefs, she also loved giving chefs a wider platform to share not only their skills and favorite dishes, but also their understanding of where good food comes from, who makes it, and why we should value it. Someone who is Julia's kind of advocate is chef and restaurateur Sheldon Simeon. Born and raised in Hilo, on the Big Island of Hawaii, Sheldon's love of cooking comes straight from his family's Filipino roots. After attending culinary school in Hawaii and working in restaurants on Maui, Sheldon became well-known after competing on Bravo's Top Chef, winning fan favorite in both seasons 10 and 14, then garnering further acclaim after opening Star Noodle in Maui. He opened his first solo restaurant in Maui, Tin Roof, in 2016, which he continues to run with his wife, Janice, serving local takeaway dishes. In 2018, he opened Lineage, his second solo restaurant serving traditional local Hawaiian fare in Wailea on Maui. It was named a James Beard Award semifinalist for Best New Restaurant in 2019. However, in 2020, Sheldon left Lineage to focus on writing his first cookbook, Cook Real Hawaii, published in the spring of 2021 by Clarkson Potter. Sheldon joins us today to tell us more about the real food of Hawaii and to talk about his new cookbook. Welcome to the podcast, Sheldon.
Hello, Todd. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. We're glad you could be here. So tell us, how are things in Hawaii right now?
You know, well, it's still paradise, if you're wondering, out there.
Well, no, that's reassuring to hear.
Yeah, I live in a beautiful place. You know, like everywhere else, this past 2 years for restaurant-wise, it's been difficult. And, you know, we're trying to kind of go with keeping our place paradise and keeping it safe. It's nice to welcome back visitors, and but give the islands a little bit of a rest so that we can keep it in safe and in core for the people who live there.
I mean, would you say the impact on Hawaii to the economy and to the health of the people was quite similar to what was going on in the mainland? Or did the natural environment and good weather help? Or how would you characterize it?
You know, it was actually a moment that we had a pause in the islands and let our islands kind of give a time to rest. You know, in the beginning, we did have no traveling to the islands. So all the locals got to enjoy our beaches and, you know, our roads and our mountains as if it was old Hawaii. And, you know, as things, we could get things more safe. It was nice to welcome back tourism back and get our economy started back up.
And presumably the hit to the economy was profound since tourism is a big part. But what was also health-wise, would you say Hawaii, like in terms of people getting COVID and getting sick or even worse, dying, would you say it was pretty similar to the mainland? Or do you think Hawaii fared a bit better?
I think it was pretty similar to what you would see. You know, in the beginning, we did have a moment where there was no cases. But being that we are an island and, you know, our resources are limited, we had to keep things locked down and safe just so that our hospitals, you know, and our medical centers don't get overrun. You know, this last Delta virus kind of put things for a spin, and it did kind of hit the islands pretty hard, but I think we've got that under control. And, you know, hopefully our leaders can continue to guide us in the right direction and make things safe for locals and visitors alike.
Okay, well, that sounds like the right way to think about it. Thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah.
So, turning to a little less morbid topic, I was hoping that you would break down, because I know from looking at your work that this is really important to you. Tell us, from your perspective, what the difference between Hawaiian food and Hawaii food is, and why is that difference important to understand?
Right. I think it's like two categories, you know, that Hawaii foods encompasses all the food that you find in Hawaii. Hawaiian is that specific food of the Kanakas, the people who discovered Hawaii, the native people, and, you know, them, those food traditions that they brought from traveling across the Pacific Ocean and cultivated the land. So that's Hawaiian food, is very specific. Again, the food of the native people, the Hawaiians, and then Hawaii food encompasses all the different cultures that migrated to Hawaii and made it their home.
Now, I like to say that I'm a native Californian because I was born in Oakland. And my understanding is you were born in Hilo, which in theory would make you, by usual American parlance, a native Hawaiian. But why do you feel so strongly about that distinction?
We respect our different cultures there in Hawaii. And, you know, the Hawaiians were an amazing, amazing culture. They were the ones that set forth these islands to what a magical place that they are. No one cared for the land and you know, made this land prosper more than the Hawaiians. So we set aside that name strictly for those who made the journey over the Pacific Ocean.
So it's kind of like an honorific. It's like honoring that special legacy.
Totally. You know, I could be Hawaiian in general just because I was born and raised there, but to be Kanaka, to be native, I would never call myself that.
And I think that's an amazing distinction for Hawaii compared to other states where maybe the idea of the melting pot, or maybe because there isn't really maybe as strong a remaining indigenous population. But I wanted you to be able to share that because I know it's important to you. What are some of the examples of the flavors that you think really epitomize the food of Hawaii, that particularly maybe even represent this fusion of cultures that now exists there?
Yeah. It's amazing that we have all these different cultures that come together so seamlessly. Again, it was the work of the Hawaiians who set forth, you know, the respect of their people and the land, and every culture that came after it had to go abide by those respectful kind of rules. So the food of Hawaii is, I don't like to call it a fusion because it's not really blended. It just kind of lives in harmony with each other, you know? So The first influence was that of the Hawaiians who got there. The next were the migration of sugarcane plantation workers. My grandparents, the Filipinos, that alongside the Japanese, the Koreans, there was a Portuguese influence, a Puerto Rican, all of that all coming together, their cultures. And then as years progress, we celebrate each and every one of those cultures in Hawaiian. It comes together in all the food that you see now today.
And do you think there's a natural blending? Because obviously what you just described, as you described them, Native Hawaiians came from Polynesia. So it's all Pacific Rim cultures. Do you think that they have a certain ability to blend because they are from a similar origin of geography, or that's not really relevant?
Yeah, I think the blending also comes from what was available. A lot of these cultures had to mimic the flavors and the recipes of what they had back in its original setting, but with the limitations of what was available in Hawaii. So you tend to see these crossovers because of the same similar ingredients had to be used across the board for a different type of the different type of cuisines. Like one example is you'll see Japanese and Korean food in Hawaii, very similar in flavors, that mostly in particular is the sweetness of it. They had to celebrate the sweetness of each culture because of the bountiful amount of sugarcane that was in Hawaii. So you see like the sweet side of Japanese and Korean very accentuated because of the availability of ingredients.
And can you give us a little bit of detail? Because I'm not even sure. I don't think the sugarcane is even native to Hawaii. Like what are some of the treasures? Because a lot of the things that are associated, like you were just saying, like a certain sweetness or even the pineapple, are mostly imports to Hawaii. But how do you differentiate like truly native things, ingredients to typical things that even the Polynesians adapted?
Yeah. Let's say a Japanese teriyaki sauce or tare with balance of having sweet wine from Japan like mirin and sake, another balance of bonito and kombu. There wasn't really much of that available in Hawaii, so it was practically just like soy sauce and sugar as the base of our teriyaki sauce here in Hawaii. That's why you see a lot of things kind of marinated in teriyaki, and that's has become the Hawaiian barbecue, so to say.
But right, those are based on imported ingredients. I mean, the raw ingredients grow well in Hawaii, right? But they're not, they weren't there when the Polynesians arrived in the islands. Is there one, and right, pineapples too are like so associated with Hawaii, but they were imported as well, weren't they originally?
Right, I think the native food of the Hawaiians have stayed intact just because a lot of that has been through, you know, gathering and foraging. So, you know, the native seaweeds and the salts, the plants as taro and, you know, bananas. And those things are kept very, very simple, whether it's grilled over kiawe wood or buried under, you know, some hot stones in an imu. So the native Hawaiian food has kind of stayed intact. I think everything else, the different cultures, like I mentioned, later on kind of fused together and blended their flavors.
So you've termed these kind of specific cultural groups that you talk about, the influencers in your book. And I was hoping that you'd share kind of like how you think about these different influencers shaping what, you know, you're calling real Hawaii food. How did they do that?
I think it was fun to, you know, tongue-in-cheek of using the word influencers that nowadays kids, I do high school talk stories. It's like, I want to be an influencer. It's like, okay, what is, when true, you know, in Hawaii, we had these true influencers, and you see how they kind of changed the history of Hawaii in it. And, you know, it was an easy way for us to connect modern with history back there, so. The
influencers. Well, I love that, right? That everybody's grandmother was actually an original influencer and grandpa in what they were king. But how do you think they did that? How did it branch out to be something, I think, as you described, that is accepted by Hawaiians of all backgrounds as part of the culture, even though it might have a distinct either kimchi component from Korean culture or another component from Filipino culture. How do you think that ended up happening?
Yeah, I think it started in these neighborhoods. Like Hawaii is very family oriented, and you know, knowing your neighbors and helping out, you know, your community is huge in part of making that whole place work properly. So, you know, back in the day, I had stories of my grandparents telling me of sharing food during lunchtime as they sat around during lunch, and they traded off food. My dad always wanted to trade his Filipino lunch with the Japanese man, and hoping that he would get some tempura or a little bit of rice noodles in exchange for his adobo and his pinoc bit. And I think then eventually as time went on, these restaurants from these communities start opening up, and you start to have those things in your refrigerator. I didn't know that I had kimchi in my refrigerator the whole time I grew growing up. You know, I'm 100% Filipino. I thought that was part of my culture growing up. I thought kimchi was something that everybody had. Until this day, I still ask, like when I go to the schools, is who has kimchi inside the refrigerator? And the majority of the kids still do. So, you know, like we take these traditions and we respect each other's culture and make it part of ours. And that's the Hawaii. That's awesome. These lines are kind of erased between it, and we celebrate each other.
No, that's lovely. I feel like, do you think it's also kind of a twofold I'm piecing together, that one, Hawaiian culture from the Polynesians already has a very strong community aspect to it as underlying principles of sharing and hospitality. But I also imagine it helps when you're 5,000 miles from anywhere in the middle of the Pacific, you recognize how much you need to rely on your neighbors and friends.
That is it. You know, it was born, these food traditions were born out of necessity and have become something that we celebrate nowadays.
And do you see, like, if you could look into a crystal ball, do you imagine that this kind of set of influencers will grow, and this evolution and kind of cross-pollination of food cultures will just carry on well into the future? Or do you think because of the changing, because a lot of this has to do with waves of immigration for labor to Hawaii, that era is sort of over?
Well, I think, you know, we're trying to not let that happen. It's easy to be influenced from the outside world. Well, when something like tourism is our driving force of our economy, where we want to make things comfortable, you know, or trying to play for the whoever's coming to Hawaii. But, you know, it's one of those things that as chefs feel as a responsibility is to continue these traditions and continue it on for the keiki, for the kids. My children, I try to celebrate all of our traditions and, you know, keep what makes Hawaii unique of this celebration of everyone's different cultures. Hopefully my kids can continue that on, you know. It was awesome a few months ago that we got to celebrate Boys and Girls Day in Hawaii and eat mochi and fly carps and kites in the yard and still have those traditions.
That's great. So do you feel like if you wrote another, like, the sequel, Cook Real Hawaii 2, in 10 or 15 years' time, it would have a new set of influencers? Or is your hope that actually you're sort of keeping the existing traditions alive and don't expect them to just keep evolving and adding new components?
I think there has been a slight, you know, a little bit more different cultures that has influenced. You know, there's a Vietnamese culture and Micronesian culture, and it would be awesome to include their traditions in this next sequel of a book that we're putting out. This energy you're putting out, Todd, I guess we're doing another cookbook.
But I'm adding to your workload as we speak.
I would love to, this next one is like, how are we upkeeping these traditions from, 20 years or 100 years ago as we continue on? I think that will be the sequel, this new age. You know, it's awesome to see chefs take traditional Hawaiian fare and bring it to light in new, new exciting ways. Chef Ed Kenny, who is chef owner of Mud Hen Water, the things that they're doing there where they're taking native bananas and burying it under coals and presenting it in this like modern neighborhood restaurant. I think it's awesome that there's chefs out there that are celebrating tradition yet pushing the envelope of modernism.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to your comment about bananas because I interviewed the food writer B. Wilson, who was saying that naturally there are hundreds or thousands of variety of bananas, but in most Western countries, only one or two varieties are imported and are grown. Does Hawaii have some heritage bananas that you can actually get and taste the difference?
Yeah, totally. There's like 100 varieties of heirloom bananas that the Polynesians brought up with them. And, you know, red bananas, cooking bananas, sweet bananas, short tart apple bananas that the skin is completely black, but when you open it up, it's just beautiful, almost like pudding-like consistency that is just to die for. And as we start to look at all these different things that the Hawaiians brought with them, the different heirloom taros that grow in dry land, that grow in the wetland, things that actually grow better at higher altitudes than they would closer to the ocean. And alongside the chefs, first and foremost, are these people who work the land, the farmers, and keeping these varietals alive. They're the heroes of the culinary world out there in Hawaii.
Well, that's great. That's great and reassuring to hear, and makes me look forward to. I assume you certainly have to venture outside your resort to try a multitude of bananas in Hawaii.
That's it. I encourage that. You know, for people who visit to Hawaii, is to, we might have worked hard in your place, and it's, believe me, drinking a Mai Tai on the side of the pool at the hotel is a wonderful thing. But I think Hawaii, and to really like, you know, share your experience of Hawaii, is get out of the resorts and see what the communities are doing.
All right. After the break, we'll come right back and we'll talk further with chef and restaurateur Sheldon Simeon about his new cookbook, Cook Real Hawaii. Stay with us.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Greetings from Cheeselandia, the ultimate community of cheese lovers. Cheeselandia is your golden pathway to the world of Wisconsin artisanal cheese, where you can immerse yourself in a vibrant society of cheese, in real life and online. Join this community of fellow travelers from all 50 states on the cheeseway of life and enjoy member-only events. Attend the School of Cheese, pursue cheese quests, and apply to host your own Cheeselandia house party. Visit wisconsincheese.com/cheeselandia to join.
Welcome back. We're talking to chef and restaurateur Sheldon Simeon about what defines the food of Hawaii today and his new cookbook, Cook Real Hawaii. So, Sheldon, give us more of a primer on the dishes that really represent to you real Hawaii food. Like, what should we know about pupus and poke and loko moko and salmon?
Yeah, so a lot of these dishes are dishes that seem very native on the surface. It might look very Japanese or it might look very Portuguese, but it's all these combinations of history and time that it was created in Hawaii. These fun foods that are has come out of specific moments in Hawaii, like the celebration of canned goods, sardines and Spam, you know, because of the World War II era in Hawaii. Mm. Native things like the lau lau, you know, slow cooked and wrapped and steamed off for 8 hours in this beautiful taro leaf. Poke, native style Hawaiian style, and then spicy tuna and what you would see in the poke markets nowadays. So it's a lot of these things is through my lens of growing up in Hawaii, and then, you know, being a chef of Hawaii, I'm trying to represent all these different parts of history that has influenced our food in this cookbook.
Well, and I think it's great. Like the poke bowl has just traveled. I can get it on the corner down here in London at this place, but I'm sure it's not nearly as good. And I'm not sure where the fish comes from. But like, what's your favorite poke bowl? And does it represent your own like twist, or is it a really traditional one that a lot of people would recognize in Hawaii?
Yeah, I think in the poke that I like is very traditional, and I think you have to kind of grow up in Hawaii to really celebrate that, just because it's a blending of the different forage seaweeds that you would find in Hawaii. And the two seaweed lipoa and seaweed limokohu is things that come from specific areas in the islands, and, you know, a lot of families kind of keep the secret of where they harvest these different seaweeds. And that's how I like my poke. Very fresh fish, and just a little bit of hand-picked pa'akai, sea salt, and then those two different seaweeds mixed in it.
And since we're all audio, can you give us kind of a visual and taste description of these seaweeds, maybe in compared to how they, you know, something people would be more familiar mm-hmm. with, like nori?
Yeah. So nori has a umami finish, you know, very forward and crisp. The reason why I like these two different types of seaweeds is the salinity and the brininess of it, too. So lipoa, you'd usually a lot of see it right next to the river mouth. So there's this brininess of almost like the salinity of the water, kind of like oysters to it. Mm-hmm. And then to limokohu, it's like a pungent, almost iodine kind of flavor in the back in all the great ways. A hint of bitterness to kind of mix up with the fresh saltiness and freshness of the fish. So it's amazing. It's again one of those things that you're lucky if you have a taste in Hawaii to have that, and you won't find those actually in the supermarkets. You'd have to be invited into someone's home to have that flavor of those seaweeds.
Well, it sounds very enticing for sure. So people will have to be very friendly to get those special invitations.
There you go.
And now you also wax quite poetic about salmon. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, again, salmon, the noodle of Hawaii. And on the surface, it looks like ramen. But again, salmon will not be found in Japan. It all kind of came together. Definitely Japanese-based, but there's influence of Chinese having, you know, the roast pork in there. And maybe a little bit of Filipino from the pork in the broth, but very simple, very chewy, ramen-like noodles, a clear broth, usually with a protein base of maybe some pork in the background, and then always simple, maybe one fish cake, a little bit of scallions, but it was my cereal growing up. It was funny because I tell this story. That, you know, I really didn't know what cereal was. I knew what it was, but I'd never ate it growing up. It was always a bowl of salmon that I ate for breakfast. But I love it.
And would you characterize salmon as a real Hawaii food or Hawaiian?
It is a Hawaii food, yes, true and true.
And is that sounds like something that is maybe easier to find and more accessible than the special seaweeds that you were talking about? Are there plenty of places you can find to grab some?
Yes, there are many salmon houses that has been open for 70 plus years. One in particular is like Palace Salmon over in Honolulu. A lot of the diners, old diners that you will see, you can even get salmon at McDonald's in Hawaii if you're pressed to have some salmon flavor. It's actually pretty delicious that you go to McDonald's and you can get salmon.
Wow. Well, that's quite an endorsement. If you just can't find it elsewhere. So I wanted to ask you, and you kind of touched on this a little bit, maybe when you referencing Hawaiians' love of certain canned foods. And so what do you think is most underappreciated about the way that local Hawaiians cook and eat? Is it the affection for Spam, or is it something else?
No, I think it's our affection for just like respecting food for what we have in front of us, you know, and may you make the best of what is available. For a moment in time that the canned food rations was a big thing, you know, at the turn of World War II, and it became a staple. And then everyone influenced that into their traditions. I grew up in a Filipino household having Spam cooked with calabaza or sweet pumpkin that was grown in our yard and stewed down. The invention of the Spam musubi, which is a sushi-like Spam, so to say, sushi. So you'll see, like, when ingredients come in through the history of Hawaii, and it's what is being used and its availability at that moment, it starts to become tradition, so to say.
Now, are there now people producing like artisan Spam, or almost any recipe, or if you got served Spam, it would be the original from Hormel in the can?
Yeah, I mean, Hormel is still yet the largest, you know, used luncheon meat there is in Hawaii. Spam, you can't get away from it. But there are places like Chef Keone at Kaunamana Farms and Chef Rob over at Musu Bar, where they're taking local heirloom pigs, like these pigs that are finished on macadamia nuts and mangoes and bananas, and then they take those beautiful Berkshire pigs and make Spam, you know, something that is so humble, yet to be able to use beautiful pork and create something nostalgic is I think it's really rad.
And does it change the flavor profile a lot though, or does it just enhance it?
It enhances it. It has like this beautiful sweetness to it. These guys are magicians in the way that they've kind of mimicked the texture and the form of what Spam is. But again, you knowing exactly where that ingredient came from and knowing that the time was put in to raise those pigs, it just makes for a better experience in the end.
Now, I was interested in your fried garlic technique. Is that a specific invention of your own, or does it have a root in Filipino cooking? What's the story behind that?
Well, we always love topping things off with fried garlic. And at the restaurant, we will do these in 10 to 15 pound batches. But we needed something to translate into the home because I still wanted our readers to be able to have fried garlic, and it's something that we came up with for the cookbook, and it turned out amazing. I gotta give that props to my co-author Garrett Snyder, who was the one that championed that technique, and we brought it home. But it's amazing. I wish we had ability to have a large microwave and to be able to do it that way, because the consistency of that fried garlic is amazing. Again, that can be done in your home.
And so when you do it for the restaurant, are you doing a different method because you're doing it in such a large batch, or what's
right? Right. We're doing it in a large pot that has about 5 gallons of oil. Also you need a pot that's going to keep it from overflowing. So, you can literally take a bath in the pot that we fry our garlic in. And I think a most majority of people don't have a pot and something that can keep them safe for making fried garlic. So we created that technique.
And the technique itself, is that your own creation? Is it kind of, it's not something necessarily traditional to Filipino food or another type of Hawaiian?
Correct, yeah. That was something that we kind of came up with from seeing what other chefs have done in the past. So just so that people can enjoy fried garlic at home.
It sounds delicious. Actually, sorry, I'm now realizing that, especially since we're only audio. Can you just describe what's unique? Because it's a specific both technique and consistency. And then I assume it also slightly gives. So maybe just tell us what you do to what your fried garlic is.
Yeah. So fried garlic, we just take what we do is we slightly blanch it first to get the harsh bitterness of the garlic out. Then we put it into a bowl of oil, and then slowly crisp it up in like 30-second intervals in the microwave. And once it gets to a beautiful golden brown, we strain it out and then lay it out on a piece of paper towel. And then what you have is this very perfumey garlic oil in one bowl, and then this bright, sweet flavor of fried garlic that's gonna top off whatever your fried rice, your garlic noodles, your fish, that whatever you're doing it. But it has all the best essence of garlic.
Presumably, you start with, you take bulbs of garlic and you peel them first, and then do you crush them or because it's very finely, like it's like
correct
a fine little topping. So when do you do the mincing or the crushing?
Yes. So you would take bulbs of garlic, get them peeled, and then mince them in the beginning. And then you take that and then you blanch and after blanching, you squeeze out the excess water that is in the garlic, put it in a bowl of just some neutral grapeseed oil or canola oil. And then what we're trying to do is slowly warm up that garlic to a crisp. So the microwave is amazing for that, where you can control it in these, you know, 20-second, 30-second intervals and watch the garlic kind of crisp and get golden brown. And then strain it out and let it drain on a piece of paper, and it crisps right up. And it's actually an amazing technique. I love it. I love seeing people post their victories on Instagram of making and being so stoked for something as simple as fried garlic.
So in the restaurant, when you're doing, because obviously you've just described, there's multiple steps to that this technique to essentially get a flavorful topping. So it is time consuming and you have to do it carefully. So do you use a microwave in the restaurant?
No, in the restaurant, what we do is we'll grind up about 10 pounds of garlic in a Roboku food processor. We'll do a large pot blanching techniques where it's salted water. And then we blanch the garlic very quickly, chill it into some ice water. What we'll do is we'll drain that out, put that on some piece of paper towel, and let that kind of air dry in the refrigerator. While that's air drying, we get a vat of fryer oil or in a big stainless steel pot with high sides. And then we go ahead and deep fry the garlic in these big batches. But it's kind of scary because of the amount of moisture that is in the garlic. And it just takes a lot of room on the stove too. So
you just, and I presume it's easy to overdo it and then just burn your whole batch. So you need a kind of.
Yeah. It also has the tendency, like doing a deep fried turkey, of exploding. Overflowing and exploding and going onto your stove and creating a fire. So we wanted something that was much more approachable at home.
So when you're making these batches, does the aroma permeate the entire like square block of where your restaurant kitchen is?
It does. Everyone, all the offices and our neighbors have tend to learn to love that smell.
I thought you were going to say complain, but that's a great way to frame it. I also wanted, because I like these and you don't see them very often, and I didn't realize that they are, I think, possibly native to Hawaii. You talk, and I can't remember the Hawaiian name for fiddlehead ferns.
Yeah, so ho'i'o are Hawaiian native ferns. It's something that I grew up having, you know, and it's fun because in the Philippines, you know, my grandparents would pick them as kids. So when they came to Hawaii, they were so happy to see that. And, you know, there's also fiddleheads in Japan. So these cultures that made Hawaii their home, they were so excited to see that they had things that they could forage and create these recipes for themselves. And one of my, I always say this is when I pass, bury me in the ho'i'o field. I don't know. I just get lost when I'm looking for the fiddlehead ferns, you know, under the bushes. They kind of pop out and reach for the sun, and you kind of have to kind of blur your eyes to find them. And it's always a fun thing that we did as kids, is going to the fiddlehead fern patch and picking some.
Wow, that's a wonderful image. And so how is there a recipe in the book of how you prepare a fiddlehead ferns, maybe as a salad?
Yes, so we take the fiddlehead ferns, we wash it very good just because of where it's growing. A lot of times you see it at the edges of rivers, in the marsh, you know, it'll be under a big canopy of a tree. So you got to get all of the dirt that is in the fiddlehead washed out really well. Right after that, a quick blanch in some salted water. And the recipe that we use is a very umami-forward salad, of flavoring it with some dried squid and some dried shrimp, a little bit of seaweed, and then some fresh tomatoes and sweet Maui onions to finish it off. But what you have is this texture from the crunchy fiddlehead ferns, the chewiness of the dried shrimp. It's one of our favorites. And you'll see this this particular salad a lot when there's large family gatherings. One thing that we celebrate in Hawaii a lot is first birthdays. Back in the day, to have your child make it through the first year was an amazing feat. So we continue that tradition of celebrating its first birthday, and we have these huge celebrations, and you'll always find fiddlehead fern salad there. My son's birthday, we had, you know, 300 plus guests there. So it was all hands on deck of cleaning of some fiddlehead ferns and making a bigger bunch of salad.
Oh, wow. Well, yeah, that's great. Thanks for sharing that with us. All right, we're going to take another break, and we'll be back with Sheldon's Julia Moment. Get in touch. Send us an email or a voice memo to contact@juliachildfoundation.org, or better yet, tweet us @juliachildjcf and let us know what you think about today's show. We'll be right back.
When you flip anything, you really, you just have to have the courage of your convictions, particularly if it's sort of a loose mass like this. Well, that didn't go very well. See, when I flipped it, I didn't have the courage to do it the way I should have. But you can always pick it up, and if you're alone in the kitchen, who is going to see?
From Julia's immortal words, we move into our last segment, which we call the Julia Moment. Here's when we ask our guests to share their favorite Julia memory, moment, or how she's inspired them in their career. Sheldon, what's your Julia Moment?
My Julia Moment is culinary school. When, you know, growing up in Hawaii, I didn't actually know who Julia Childs was until I went to culinary school. But she reminded me so much of my aunt. That every time my auntie, when I would cook in her kitchen, she'd always be over my shoulder and making sure that everything is tidy and clean, making sure that I'm not tasting from the spoon whatever stew or soup that I'm cooking from. So, you know, that warmness of Julia reminded me so much of my Auntie Marie, who has influenced my cooking so much throughout my life. She's always over my shoulder. Auntie Marie on one side and Julia Childs on the other.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, no, and I think people have said that a lot, that Julia, even from teaching them on TV, it feels exactly like you described, like an aunt or a mother or a grandmother or maybe even a grandfather, you know, kind of standing over you, giving you advice. So I think that's a great, great connection. Thank you. And thanks for joining us today, all the way from Hawaii.
My pleasure. This was amazing to be able to speak about the food of Hawaii, as always.
Well, it was great for us to hear about it. It was definitely a mouthwatering and entrancing journey. I'm sure everyone is hoping they can get to Hawaii as soon as possible. So thank you again for joining us, and thanks everyone for listening. You can find Sheldon at Chef Wonder. And for the latest menu at Tin Roof, if you're lucky enough to get to Maui, it's at Tin Roof Maui on Instagram and Twitter. The cookbook is Cook Real Hawaii by Sheldon Simeon, with Garrett Snyder and photographs by Kevin J. Miyazaki. It's out now from Clarkson Potter. Ask or search for it at your favorite bookseller. If you're not already following the foundation, what are you waiting for? It's at Julia Child on Facebook and at Julia Child Foundation on Instagram. It's at Julia Child JCF, and I'm at T. Shulkin on Twitter. The Julia Child audio clip from The French Chef is used with permission from our friends at WGBH. Thanks to my co-producer of the foundation, Lauren Salkeld, and our sound engineer at Heritage Radio Network, Matt Patterson. Our theme song is New French Horn by Novi Valtorni. We're on the air on Heritage Radio Network on Thursdays at 4 p.m. Eastern, 1 p.m. Pacific, with downloads available soon after wherever you find your podcasts. We look forward to bringing you back into the Foundation's world next time on Inside Julia's Kitchen. Inside Julia's Kitchen is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.